I feel like there should be a clock in the corner of the screen. Good afternoon. I am Hopeton Hay. I am the host of the Diverse Voices Book Review podcast, which is available through Apple, iHeartRadio, and many other podcast platforms. I'm also the founder and producer of the 6th Annual Celebration of Diverse Literary Voices of Texas. The annual celebration of Diverse Literary Voices of Texas started in December of 2016 as a way to bring together writers addressing the social, political, racial, and cultural issues facing communities of color. Before we get to our debut author conversation, let me share with you other sessions we have coming up next Saturday. Next Saturday morning at 10 a.m., we will have a panel discussion titled Underreported, Resonating Issues in the Black Community. It will be moderated by Austin journalist Alberta Phillips and featuring Travis County Commissioner Jeffrey Trevelyan from here in Texas and Austin journalist Roxanne Evans. And finally, we'll close out the 6th Annual Celebration of Diverse Literary Voices of Texas next Saturday at 12:30 p.m., and I'll be moderating a discussion of the book, Civil Rights in Black and Brown, Histories of Resistance and Struggle in Texas. It will feature the co-editors of the book, Max Crockmull and J. Todd Moy, and one of the contributors, Jasmine Howard. But we are here today for an author conversation, Debut Books of Fiction by Women of Color. The panel features authors Yasmin Ango, Dalia Azim, and Cynthia Banu, and writer Choitali Sen is moderating the panel and will introduce the authors first. But let me introduce Choitali Sen. Choitali Sen is the author of the novel The Pathless Sky, which was published in 2015. And the short story collection, A New Race of Men from Heaven, which won the Mary McCarthy Prize for Short Fiction, and will be published by Sarah Band Books in January 2023. Her stories and essays have appeared in Boulevard, Echotome, receiving a special mention in the 2019 Best American Short Stories Anthology, Shenandoah, New England Review, New Ohio Review, Colorado Review, Electric Literature, Lit Hub, Los Angeles Review of Books, Catapult, and many other publications. She is a graduate of the Hunter College with an MFA in fiction, and she is founder of the interview series Borderless Conversations on Art, Action, and Justice. She has been a frequent panelist, presenter, and instructor for the Writers League of Texas, Grub Street's Muse and Marketplace Conference, the Texas Book Festival, and the Asian American Writers Workshop, and was a featured writer at the New Voices Festival at Ithaca College in 2017, and the first annual Tasvir South Asian Literary Festival in Seattle in 2019. I present to you Choitali Sen.
Thank you, Hopeton. Thank you for inviting me again to participate in the Diverse Voices Book Festival. And I just want to say that I've learned a lot about how to interview authors from listening to Hopeton over the years. He's one of my favorite interviewers. And I've heard other authors say that too. So thank you. It's an honor to be here. And especially with this panel of authors, I'm so happy to be able to talk about these books with you all. So I'm going to introduce each of our panelists, beginning with Yasmin Ango. Hailing from Northern Virginia, Yasmin Ango is a first-generation Ghanaian-American who grew up in two cultural worlds. She taught English in middle and high schools for years, served as an instructional coach for virtual teachers, and worked as a freelance developmental and copy editor. Yasmin received the 2020 Eleanor Taylor Bland Award for Emerging Writers of Color from Sisters in Crime, of which she's a proud member. She lives in South Carolina with her beautiful blended family. And her book is called Her Name is Night. You can order it now using the order links that are up on the Facebook page and on the homepage. Next, I'll be talking to Dalia Azim. Dalia is the author of the novel Country of Origin, which is forthcoming in April 2022. Her work has appeared in American Short Fiction, Aperture, Columbia, a Journal of Literature and Art, Glimmer Train, Other Voices, and The Washington Post, among other places. And she lives in Austin, Texas. And finally, we have Cynthia Banu, whose fiction has appeared in Granta, New England Review, Glimmer Train, and elsewhere. She's the recipient of an O. Henry Award, the Disquiet Literary Prize, an Elizabeth George Foundation grant, and scholarships from the Breadloaf and Sewanee Writers Conferences. A longtime newspaper reporter, she has worked for the New York Times and the Washington Post. She's a graduate of the Michener Center for Writers at UC Berkeley's and UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism and Carnegie Mellon University. And she lives here in Austin, Texas. Her story collection, Seeking Fortune Elsewhere, is forthcoming this March, and you can pre-order Dalia's and Cynthia's books using the links on our page. So welcome, everyone.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So Yasmin, I'd like to start with you. I wanted to ask you about your main character, Nina, although she goes by many different names, she is possibly the most sympathetic assassin I've ever read. And I just thought that she was such a gripping character. And I was so invested in her story just from the first page. So can you talk about how this character emerged from you, for you, and when, I guess from you as well, when did you first start thinking about her and how did you get to know her? How did she come alive on the page?
Right. Well, she really, Nina Knight, really just kind of, I don't even really know how to explain it. I had like a little idea of, oh, I want to write about this really like strong woman who is, you know, her line of work is something that is not traditional, and it's not something that is, you know, easy to accept. And I just was like, well, I guess I'll make her maybe an assassin, but like, how do you make an assassin where, you know, the reader will kind of empathize with them and we'll care about them and not like totally hate them. And so as I started, and that's really how I just really started writing her. I didn't have any particular path that I wanted to go with her. So the book is written in dual timeline. So you get her as a child and then her as an adult. And I really felt like I had, for me to get to know her, I had to write her in order. So I had to write her before is her childhood first, so that I could kind of know how she became this assassin, why she became this assassin, and really get to know her as an adult so that the reader could then kind of understand why she became one and what really drives her and, you know, how this is a job that she has. And it's just a job, but it's not what drives her. It's not what makes her. It doesn't define who she is and where she's been. Where she's been is what has, you know, driven her and has made her into the person. And so the assassin is just a tool in which she uses to, you know, support herself and to, you know, kind of get out some angers that, you know, she has, trying to work through some things that she's working through. So, yep, that's how she came to be.
That's fascinating. And I think the way that you did it was very effective. Could we hear a little bit from the book?
Oh, sure. So I'm going to read from one of her before chapters, which is her as her 14-year-old self. So it is, before I became Echo, before I was Nina, I was Aninye. And this is my story, my recounting of who I was, of how I came to be. My journey begins in my small village, nestled among the plush, vibrant green forest and cocooned on Aburi Mountain. If one is looking for me, they will often find me on the cliffs overlooking the world below. My favorite time of day is early morning when everything is still dewy and the fog is low-lying and heavy, but burns away as the sun comes up. It's hot in Ghana, not uncommon for the late summer. This year has been a good year with a fair amount of rain, which allowed crops and our animals to grow well enough to sell at market and feed the village. We are prospering. Here on the mountain, the temperature is cooler though, perfect. On a clear day, I can stand on the cliff, look out through the dissipating fog and see Accra, only 25 miles away, but seeming so much farther from where I stand. The deep valleys below constantly remind me of how beautiful my home is, of its richness, of how lucky I am to be an African, a Ghanaian, a Nkankuian. Papa says to mind our business and do not covet. What our brother and sister has, yet, yes, I know, Aninye, Ofori, my brother rolls his eyes, does not mean I cannot worry about what happens to me after Wisdom assumes leadership and Josiah becomes his counsel. When Ofori gets this way, jealous over things our older brothers have, and he does not, I strain from not slapping him senseless. Wisdom, tall, fierce, brave Wisdom, who not only inherited Papa's Christian name, but has a name that reflects his demeanor, will assume the title of chief as firstborn when Papa steps down. Josiah is 3 minutes Wisdom's junior and will come Wisdom's chief advisor. You should be glad there are no responsibilities binding you to Nkankwe like them, I told Ofori. Why he does not see his luck, I do not know. The kitchen of our home is a warm blend of cooking spices and sweetened pastry. Auntie, Mama's closest cousin who stepped in when Mama passed, glistens as she stands over a cast iron pot of bubbling bean stew laden with bits of salted codfish. In a minute, Auntie will heat a pan of oil to fry the ripened sweet plantains. Bean stew and fried plantains are Papa's and my favorite. I consider all this as Ofori steals a bofrot, a small round ball of sweetened fried dough. In the background, Auntie complains he will ruin his dinner. Diligently, I count bofrots in my head, dividing them by the six of us. I grimace because Ofori has already had more than his share. Auntie says, Ofori, you should be with your papa and the twins, seeing to the end of the day. Why? He asks, popping the last of his stolen goods in his mouth. Why what? She asks. Why should I follow them around when I will never govern? They do not need me. You will be on the council of elders, Ofori. That is important work because a chief cannot rule well without his council. Our auntie says as she flaps her free hand at him, now leave this woman's work and see to your father at the village center. My shoulders jerk as if pierced with a sharp stick. That auntie delegates where the place of women and men should be is archaic, and I have no plans to adhere to it. All right, I'll just stop there.
Thank you. That's such a lovely, tender start. We're going to talk to Dahlia next. Dahlia, I was lucky enough to read an advanced copy of your book, which is coming out soon. And your story starts during a political revolution in Egypt in 1952. And what moved me so much about the story was that how you wove together the hopes and dreams of a country with the hopes and dreams of the people in one particular family. And I thought what came out was just how inextricably intertwined these were. And I thought partly you did that by exploring the voices and perspectives of four very different people of different generations, but related characters, and especially related to the hopes pinned on this emerging, country and on, a former colony, and it's tied to the history of Egypt at the time. So I was wondering, what was it about the story you wanted to tell that led you to this kind of narrative structure?
Thank you. I appreciate your reading the book in general, and that really great question, which it makes me really happy, because I feel like one of the goals I had with the narrative is really highlighting these parallels between political and personal freedom and the ways that the different characters in the book really run up against limitations to their personal freedom. I didn't always have the book beginning as Cairo was born and burning in 1952 at the outset of the revolution, but I found my way there pretty quickly in terms of like finding the heart of the narrative in that revolution. And one thing that really interested me with the first character that's explored in the novel, she's a young woman who is basically on the verge of of having an arranged marriage set up for her by her father. And I wanted to draw out this idea of her really being inspired by the revolution taking place around her as a way to think about her own personal freedom, or how she might ascertain freedom, or just sort of the irony of, you know, the country is coming out from under like political oppression, many years, centuries of political oppression, and yet nothing is changing for her. Nothing changes for women in this era, and arguably even until today, although things have changed somewhat, you know, not radically enough in my opinion. And then when it comes to the other characters, going back to that point about revolution and personal freedom, I was just sort of exploring the walls that they hit in their lives. One of them has limitations that are imposed by basically not being part of the middle class, being part of the lower class. And then there is a character who experiences political oppression, politically motivated, basically incarceration. And then the final character in the book struggles with mental health issues. So I just wanted to really kind of braid all those narratives together. And I'm really glad to hear that you found that echo in the book, because that was definitely one of my goals.
That's wonderful. Can we hear a little bit from your book?
Sure. I'm going to read a short passage from near the beginning of the book. Halle, 1952. The murmurings of my mother's radio usually started up around noon, when she finally woke up and took her tea. I was lying in bed next door in my room one day when I heard her shriek and demand, "What?" as if she were talking to the radio. I got up and moved closer to the wall that separated us, picking up the faintest bits of the broadcast, new leadership, land redistribution, effective immediately. And then my mother started crying, which was something she never did, and I went rigid, fearing the worst. In spite of my concern, I stayed in my room for the rest of the afternoon, too despondent to tackle another crisis. The night before, I'd met the man my father wanted me to marry, and the thought of having to spend my life with him made me want to end it. The only bright spot in my mind was the fact that my father was scheduled to host another gathering of his comrades that Friday, and I hoped to see Khalil again. My father returned home hours after dark, his typical schedule lately. When I heard the front door open, I listened as my mother loudly tromped downstairs in her hard-soled, high-heeled shoes, and then I quietly opened the door. "Why didn't you tell me this was going to happen?" my mother yelled in the foyer, her voice echoing off the stone floors and rising to the top of the lofted ceiling. "I would have at least tried to sell to the farmers who've been leasing the land. Now they're just going to get it for free." My father's loud laugh boomed. "You would have tried to sell it? When was the last time you even went to visit those precious acres? Who's the one who visits those farms every month to collect the rent? Who's the one who got you those tenants in the first place? Your father was so rich and complacent that he didn't care that most of the land he owned lay fallow. It was me who drummed up that business after I came into the family. Or don't you remember? That land has been in my family for generations. You can't expect me to just let it go," my mother argued. "It's not me asking you to give it up. You have no choice, and neither do I." "You're a real son of a bitch," my mother shrieked, and then she started to cry again. I waited for my father to yell back, but his response was calm and measured. "We took control of this country, promising to build a more equitable system. The vast majority of Egypt is owned by just 2% of the population. Do you really want to be a part of that 2%? We can't kick out the king for his excesses while turning a blind to families like yours. The only way to create a fair system is to start fresh. Whose side are you on? My mother demanded, her voice still full of emotion. I'm on everyone's side, my father said in a tone that indicated he was done with the conversation. I heard his footsteps move toward the stairs, so distinct from the patter of my mother's, and I shut my door. Thank you.
Thank you. What a fraught situation to start off with. Thank you, Dahlia. Cyndia, I'm really looking forward to reading your whole collection. I've read some of your stories that have been up in literary magazines, including Maliga Holmes in Granta and Different in the Master's Review. Two stories that I thought really beautifully brought out the challenges of leading a connected life in this age of hyper-globalization, where the distance between people and their original homes and their families is so vast. And I know that a story collection comes together differently than a novel. Can you talk about how this collection came together? When did you first start writing these stories? And did you always have some thematic unity in mind, or did that emerge later?
Thank you. Thanks for the question. And it's great to be here with all of you. I did not know that this was a collection when I was writing these stories. I had no idea. The very first story I wrote probably about 8 years ago, some version of it, and that story made it into the book. But all the rest I wrote over the course of 3 years while I was doing my MFA here at UT Austin. And I didn't know, I mean, I was working on a novel and I had these stories, and in some ways they all felt like they were the same, like I was telling the same story in a slightly different way. But I was working here with Brett Anthony Johnston, and he said, this feels like a collection and it's not the same story over and over. Actually, when you get that feeling, it's a sign that, you know, that there's a theme, that the stories, you know, might be united in some way, and the whole book could have a shape through these stories. So that kind of was how I started. But I think that when you're writing, you're kind of obsessed with the same topics and the same ideas, and that comes through in every story, and perhaps even throughout a writing career, we have these obsessions. And for me, it's this idea that immigrants always leave their families behind. I mean, you mentioned technology, and things have changed so much. People can travel, and not during the pandemic, but travel is much easier these days. We have, you know, FaceTime and WhatsApp, and you can communicate instantly. But that, what doesn't change is that families, immigrants leave, and they leave usually forever, and that will never change. And sort of the loss, what's lost because of that, I think is appears in every story that I've written.
Well, I really agree. I think those of us who write short stories or even novels do fear that we're writing the same story over and over again, I know. But, you know, that we are exploring over our careers certain obsessions. So can we hear a little bit from your book?
Yes. I just got the final copy of my book.
Oh, it's beautiful.
I need to read from it. I will read from the first story, which is Maliga Holmes that you mentioned. I'll read just 2 pages. And this story is set in a kind of comfortable, luxurious retirement community in India. South India, where many of the people who live there, their children have gone abroad. Maliga Holmes. Mr. Swaminathan died as he was walking back to his flat from the veg dining hall after dinner. He was ahead of me on the path, and I saw him slow down. His gait changed from a fast stride to a slower, hunched walk. His left arm went limp. He lost his footing and crumpled to the ground. If I had not been swift, I imagine, he would have hit his head on the concrete. There would have been blood, but I caught up with him. Before he fell, I squatted to the ground and put my hands out, and his head fell directly into my open palms. Carefully, I slipped my hands out, set his head gently on the concrete, and sat at his side talking to him. His left eye looked lower than his right. His left cheek sagged as if it might slide off. I held his hand until the ambulance arrived. It was the first time that I had held a man's hand since my husband died. The rectangular diamond on Mr. Swaminathan's gold ring was hard and cold in contrast to his warm skin. Before they loaded his body onto the gurney, he opened his eyes, looked at me, and said, "Renuka." Then he squeezed my hand. Whether he was asking me to summon his wife, or whether he thought I was his wife, I cannot say. He died before he reached the hospital. He was 75 years old, the same age my husband would be if he were alive today. His death was our first. Hard to believe since this is a place for old people. But Maliga Homes is a new facility, and the first residents, myself included, moved in just 2 years ago. The other day, I spoke to my daughter Kamala on the phone and told her how expertly the personnel handled the whole Swaminathan matter. They were prompt in calling for help, the area was cleared immediately, and the ambulance rolled right onto the freshly trimmed landscaping, crushing a row of golden dewdrop shrubs that took a year to grow. "I am so glad to hear that," Kamala said. "Maliga Homes is not a bad place. It is a rather nice place, in fact, just a bit isolated for city people like me, coming from places like Chennai and Bangalore. The facility sits at the intersection of Thambore Road and NH181, just outside of Coimbatore. Going to the outskirts of a mid-sized city gave the developers more space and allowed them to invest in luxuries that we all appreciate. We have stone tiles in the bathrooms, thermofoil cabinets, those wood laminate floors that are in style now, picturesque landscaping, and Honda inverter generators with 8 hours of runtime for when the power goes out, which it does daily. I am lucky to be here," my Kamala likes to remind me. "It is only the second place of its kind in South India, and the unit sold out quickly. Still, no amount of expensive stone or carefully worded praise from my daughter can change what Maliga Homes is, a place for those who have nowhere else to go."
Stop. Thank you. That's so moving and lovely. And I thought this whole story does such an amazing job of telling a story of immigration from the perspective of these elderly people who are left behind in this whole process. Thank you. I want to open it up now to some more general questions to all of you. And my first question is about audience. One thing I've observed about mainstream publishing industry over the last few years, and I think this is pretty constant, is that they have, these gatekeepers have a very limited knowledge or understanding of the readers that are out there. They have kind of a very stereotypical idea of who reads, and they're very risk averse. And their priority is not necessarily connecting the right book with the right reader. So I want to ask you all, at what point in the writing or publishing process did you start thinking about or imagining audience? And can you talk a little bit about any challenges you faced as your book went from something that you were working on privately to something you were trying to get out into the world? And I thought, Dahlia, maybe we could start with you on this question.
Sure, that's a tough question. It's a good question though. And I think it's good to talk about as writers and as a community. I guess I would say, in terms of thinking about audience, I personally go to reading to explore and learn. And so I'm always seeking out what I don't know. And, whether it's historical fiction or just global fiction about other cultures, it's definitely, that's usually, or even, you know, not necessarily other cultures, but just like a milieu that I'm not familiar with. So for me as a reader, I feel like that's really what I love about books and about reading. So it sort of surprises me the lack of creativity that can come out of like standard publishing. I feel like, and I know I've had friends experience the same thing. There's a back and forth sometimes between agents or publishers expressing that they want something that sort of emulates something that's been successful, and yet at the same time they're afraid to put something out in the market that might seem redundant. So there's this weird sort of, it's like, what are you looking for? And you're right. I think there is like a lot of risk aversion in publishing. I worked with an agent for a number of years, and I think she herself was very risk averse and just was very nervous about setting my book out without feeling 100% certain she could sell it. I think that's common for agents, but I ultimately felt sort of stymied in that relationship and split with her, and then found a publisher more or less on my own through the community in Texas, actually. So I guess, I mean, that's sort of a long way of saying that it's true that they say that you have to just find somebody who really shares your vision. And I'm, after a long circuitous route, I was able to find that. And, you know, I empathize with people who struggle, because I struggled a lot. And I feel like it's a very real challenge to try to get published. And especially when you're writing something that hasn't, that isn't like very obviously commercial, or that doesn't have a lot of precedence in the market already.
Thank you. Cynthia, what about you?
I sold my book in a traditional way through an agent who was excited about it, but the book was rejected 17 times before editors bid on it, so it was difficult. And I did feel discouraged, I think, in certain moments. And I think that the industry can be risk averse at times, but there are really good editors and publishers out there. And you only need one editor in the end. You only need one editor who has a good vision, who knows how to bring your book to readers. And as far as thinking about who my readers are, I don't think I was occupied with that as I was writing, but I think because my background is in journalism, I am very focused on clarity, and I'm not writing for a single reader. I'm also not writing for a generic audience. And I'm aware that, you know, a different reader, each reader might have a different read on my book, but it should be kind of still fulfilling and satisfying to each. So, you know, this story, Maliga Holmes, that I read, one person may know the places that I mentioned. Somebody may know, you know, these retirement homes in Coimbatore and that intersection. And another may not, but they could still get something out of the story in the same way as when you read a newspaper article, for instance, on Ukraine right now. Someone may know the politics and the country and the place, and someone may not, but you still learn something and get something out of it. So I think I was focused on that. You know, this is a self-contained story that I'm writing.
So interesting. Thank you. Yasmin, how would you answer this question?
Oh, wow. I love, you know, the earlier answers, but I'm going to tell you all, it was tough for me, 17 rejections. But even before I got to the editors, I must have queried, you know, over 100 agents, you know, trying to get my story out there, this particular story, and then, you know, one other that I had, you know, prior to that. And the one response that everybody gave me, it was never, you know, something was wrong with your writing. Your writing is beautiful. It's a beautiful story. I just can't connect to the character, or, you know, it's the voice, or there's just, so they could never find a connection. And how do you fix connection, right? Because I can connect, and the people that I had read my story can connect. What is this connection that this disconnect that you have? And what I came to, you know, really realize, and I didn't really want to say it, but I had to be honest with myself. And I was like, you know, is it because the people that I'm asking to read this are not, you know, people who are Black or are not people who are from Ghana or, you know, who had these experiences. And so it's hard for them to put themselves in that position. And I was hurt by that because, you know, as a Black woman, and, you know, I think many people of color, whatever we read and we watch, we are able to put ourselves in those experiences. We don't have to be, you know, a white person or a whatever in order to relate to what that story is, right? We often have to assimilate into society that is not our own. And so when you are, you know, meeting up with these gatekeepers that refuse to put themselves in these situations that are not their own because that's out of their comfort level, that's very frustrating to us because we've got all these wonderful stories to tell and we all shouldn't have as much difficulty as, you know, our other counterparts who have much more, you know, ease. And not only that, you know, sometimes the stories aren't even, you know, they don't equate. The story is not, you know, ours. Sometimes we have to put in a whole lot more work and, you know, we have to be darn near perfect, right, in our writing and everything. Whereas some others may not have that, you know, they don't have to put in as much work. So that was all very frustrating. But yes, it's true. It does take one person to finally, you know, not be afraid of any kind of pushback and not be afraid of any, you know, not be adverse to anything and to just, you know, see, recognize your work for what it really is. And so with my story, you know, I've got this immigrant person who is in this position. She's, you know, an assassin. And that's not something we usually see, you know, Ghanaian women in, right? We usually see, you know, white men as this person who's swooping in to save the day, who's a spy and who's all this other stuff. And so I think that's what kind of maybe resonated a little bit is that she looks very different from what we're used to. And I'll go with that. And I also did not have a particular reader in mind because, well, I had a reader like myself, a reader who can read anything and find enjoyment in anything that I read because I can find that relation and I don't have to look like that person or be that person to do it. And so that's the kind of reader that I was looking for, men, women, you know, any kind of, you know, whatever they identify as long as they enjoy a really good story, you know, I think you can find all different kinds of nuggets into it. So yeah, it was super hard, but I'm so thankful that I am in the place that I am and that, you know, it only takes a one yes or, you know, a couple of yeses and, you know, to get the ball rolling. So that's pretty much my story.
Well, I think it's so important that you persevered and that your book is connecting with readers. I connected with it right away. And I think sometimes in publishing, you hear these sort of stock answers, like I couldn't, and that's all they have to say, right? They don't actually have to give you, you know, a truthful reason. So thank you for pushing through all of that. We do, I want to encourage you to ask your questions in the Q&A. We do have one question. I also have many more questions. Let's continue. I'll ask this question that comes from Yasmin Merchant. Do you feel pressure as a diverse author to represent an entire demographic in such a white dominated industry? And if so, how do you navigate it? I worry because I feel like I can only write based on my experiences, which are not universal in my community. So good question. Anybody want to jump in on that? Do you feel pressure to represent whatever demographic you are considered to be part of?
Well, okay, then I'll jump in and I'll say, I don't feel pressure because I am really at the end of it, I'm going to write whatever it is that I feel like writing, whatever story comes to me naturally. And trust me, that's the kind of story you probably want to read. You don't want to read anything that I feel forced and pressured to write. And I also want to move away from the idea from anyone, from white people or even people in my culture, that I have to write a certain kind of thing because that is my culture. And I'll give my mom for example, and I don't know who can relate, but like my mom, she wasn't very happy with the fact that, you know, my main character is an assassin. She is a very, you know, religious person, and also she's very proud. She's a proud Ghanaian. And so she's like, you know, why must you write about an assassin that's so evil and all this other stuff. And I'm like, well, mom, that's the kind of story that I like, you know, and it is okay. You know, there are going to be good people and bad people who are Ghanaian, just like there are good and bad wherever. And so I'm not going to feel the pressure to write, you know, Ghanaian people on a pedestal. They are human. And I'm not going to feel pressure to write trauma stories because that might be the thing, you know, that all publishers or whatever want to read. Everybody goes through things, but trauma isn't what defines, you know, those people as, you know, being able to be read. So I definitely, if I do feel pressure, I remind myself, Yasmin, you better stop and take that pressure off and write the story that you want to tell.
Thank you. Dahlia or Cynthia, do you want to add anything?
I don't think I feel, I am writing about the South Asian American community. I don't feel pressure. I think because there are so many writers now, I don't know what it would have felt like 20 years ago or 30 years ago, but the landscape is wide and diverse, and people, there are South Asian American writers, you know, writing magical realism and science fiction and all sorts of stories about all sorts of things. So my stories, I have these specific characters in mind, and it's their stories that I'm trying to tell. I don't think I feel pressured to do more than that.
Thank you.
I'll just add, I agree with what everything that Yasmin and Cynthia have said, and that no culture is monolithic. And I think it's dangerous to imagine that a book could represent, you know, a wide-ranging culture of any kind. I think a lot about the Chimamanda Adichie TED Talk, The Danger of a Single Story, and especially I think as writers of color, just that, you know, what I think our goal should be is to just like infuse the book world with as many stories as we can, just to represent the diversity of our communities.
Yeah. I wanted to ask, what was the funnest part of writing these books for you? Cynthia, maybe we can start with you.
Yeah. There is a moment when you're in the imagined world, which is only your space. I mean, the writer is the only person who can enter that space and walk around in it and see what characters are doing and ask characters questions. But, and you often start with, at least I am often starting with some kernel of truth, but the moment when the story kind of has its own truth and kind of rises above whatever it was in the real world that you saw that got you to that point is a really, at that point, the story is probably still many drafts away from being done. But those people in that imagined world and their lives become very real. And you know, as a writer, you're trying to convey that reality to the reader, but it is a pretty magical moment.
Yasmin, how about you?
What was most fun? It probably would be my action scenes, because I really like, you know, good action, and I really enjoyed pushing her and putting her in places where, you know, she was able to kill people. And I don't know what that says about like my mindset, but it was very fun to write it when I was angry at someone too, because I could just imagine that person and what Nina was, you know, doing to them at that moment. But no, it honestly, the whole story, the being able to tell a story from beginning to end and have your words come out the way that you envision them in your head is really satisfying. And then having it received from readers, and they see all the different little, you know, parts. Echo, I think I heard someone say before, the echoes in there, you know, of the things that you really wanted them to like kind of get. So like that to me is most fun. The post writing, you know, is the most fun for me.
Great, thank you. Dahlia?
I would say for me, my favorite aspects are character building and world building. Plot and structure are much harder for me, and I don't really enjoy those, although, you know, work in progress. Maybe I'll love them someday, but I feel most comfortable when I'm in scene, trying to really add the nuance and detail to a scene to make something seem real, and then allowing my characters to inhabit those spaces and have conversations with each other.
Beautiful. I love how you all answered that. We have two, this hour is going by so fast. We have two questions from the audience. I think I can combine them. Mary Specht asks, what other writers or careers inspired you? And an anonymous attendee asks, what inspires you most to write? So they're somewhat related, somewhat different. So what other writers or careers, I think this means writers' careers, inspired you, and what in general inspires you most to write? I think whoever wants to jump in first.
I can mention the writers that inspired me. While I was working on this collection, I was reading Alice Munro and Elizabeth Strout and William Trevor, and also writers telling immigrant stories, Edwige Danticat, Adichie, Dahlia mentioned, Jhumpa Lahiri I've read long ago, but love. And Elizabeth McCracken and Brett Anthony Johnston were my teachers at UT. I was reading their work as well, but I was really interested in writers who just kind of let the day-to-day lives of their characters unfold, who are not as focused on plot as they are on character, and who kind of discover who their people are, who their characters are through the kind of activities we might consider mundane and day to day.
Thank you.
Okay, so some writers that inspire me, I really like Octavia Butler was one. Tananarive Reed Due is another, and they write more sci-fi fantasy. But I just really loved their world building, and also, you know, how they built their characters and things like that. Yaa Gyasi, she wrote Homecoming, so she is another Ghanaian author. And so I was really excited to have read her books. Gosh, there are just so many. And one person, you know, I'm gonna say him because I've read him since I was like really young, and that would be like Stephen King. And that's just because, you know, his books are really thick, and he writes a lot of like really hard concepts and really hard topics to really juggle and to talk about. And I just wanted to see how, I like how he does it, but then I also wanted, I like to add that woman's touch to it a little bit, and to see how I could do with that. And so he gave me, not he personally, but reading his books, you know, gave me a little less fear in tackling those really difficult subjects in the story.
Great. Dahlia?
Sure, there's definitely overlap. I think we should trade books, share libraries probably after this conversation. But I love Adichie and Alice Munro, and Toni Morrison, I feel like, is one of the writers that made me want to write when I was in college. I read a lot of Toni Morrison and Virginia Woolf. I love Zadie Smith and Louise Erdrich. And I could go on, but those are some of the kind of primary influences.
These are great questions. Thank you. I just want to point out that up in the chat, you can find all the links to purchase Yasmin's book and to pre-order Dahlia's and Cynthia's books. So do that right now, because you do not want to miss getting these into your hands as soon as possible. I think I'll close out, unless there are other questions coming into the Q&A, by asking what's next, or what are you preoccupied with right now? Whether it's, you know, promoting your book, or have you started on new projects? Are you just taking some time to read and relax after, you know, birthing this book. So, you know, what are some things that you're just doing and working on at the moment? So we'll just have each of you finish us off with that. And also where should we keep looking out for your work? So maybe we'll start with you, Cyndia.
My book is coming out very shortly, so I'm mostly occupied with that and don't know if I can speak coherently about what I'm working on now, but it is about the art movement that emerged in India after independence. The modern art movement is what I'm researching and writing about. And I'll quickly answer this question that the anonymous attendee asked, what inspires you the most to write? I realized that none of us spoke to that, but I think it's what Dahlia said about infusing the world with our stories so that they can be part of the record, so that they can be found. I mean, maybe now, but also maybe later, many years from now. And I think if we don't do that, then nobody else will. So that is what keeps me writing.
Thank you so much. And thank you for going back to that question. Dahlia?
Sure. I was working on, and I will be again working on another novel, which also is a historical work of fiction that takes place in Egypt, but among Western expats in the 30s and a group of archaeologists. But a friend who's actually on this, I saw her name pop up earlier, had recommended about a year ago that I focus on trying to work on some short essays and try to get my voice out there in other ways, which I can be so myopic that I really appreciated that advice and have really heeded it. And I've been focusing on some essays on historical fiction and or just sort of what my view of historical fiction is and like what the kind of rules are and what how I've woven in my own personal my family's stories into it. And then I'm doing some research and I want to do some writing. I work in my day job is at the Blanton Museum of Art in Austin, and I'm really interested in questions of repatriation, especially with Egypt opening like a state-of-the-art museum at the end of this year, and just sort of looking at collections in Texas with ancient Egyptian artifacts and just questions in general about, will these objects ever, not necessarily the ones in Texas, but will some of these major works like the Rosetta Stone ever go back to Egypt?
Amazing, thank you. And Yasmin.
Yeah, so I am finishing out my series. I finished the second book of the series back in August. So I'm in the process of, you know, copy editing and proofreading stage, plus still promoting this first book, which just came out like in November. So it's been like a whirlwind. And I don't understand how anybody can deal with anything else when it comes to promoting it and having that whole launch stuff going on. It's a lot. So those are the things that I'm working on, focusing on right now, and trying to take some time, but it's hard because it's always book thoughts at all times. So.
I want to thank all three of you for being with us and for putting these beautiful books out into the world. I think it is really essential to add to our culture and the public record, as someone said. So thank you all. And I'm going to hand it back over to Hopeton.
And thank you very much, Choi Tilly, for putting together this incredible panel. I love going to Choi Tilly and say, hey, I need a panel for the annual celebration of diverse literary voices of Texas. And I just literally just say, Choi Tilly, whatever you come up with, we will run with. So thank you so much for your great taste and your commitment to literature and introducing me to so many new writers. And thank you to the audience. Once again, we're not going to shut it down yet because we expect everyone to go to the links in the chat and buy Yasmin's book, buy Dahlia's book, buy Cyndia's book, or pre-order Cyndia, pre-order Dahlia. Yasmin's book is out there right now. And Choi Tilly, January 2023 is when your book is coming out?
Yes, it's January 28th. You have a little while, but the cover was just revealed, and pre-orders will, you can, you know, follow me on Facebook or Twitter at ChoiThaliSen2020, and I'll let you know when that pre-order link is up.
Thank you for everyone for joining the 6th Annual Celebration of Diverse Literary Voices of Texas. Debut books of fiction by women of color, and hopefully you'll be joining us in the future. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great day.